From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Jason Van Shee, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. The aim of the podcast is to rapidly increase the knowledge and application of psychological health and safety in workplaces worldwide. To help with this, we have regular guests from around the world who are leading the way in this important area. But before I introduce our guest and topic for today, allow me to introduce my co-host, Joel Mitchell. How are you, Joel?
I have bruised ribs today, Jason.
Yeah, now I've heard this story, but I would love for our listeners to hear. How did you get bruised ribs, Joel?
Yeah, it's really stupid. Really, really stupid.
That's why I want our listeners to hear.
Because, like, for such an uncomfortable injury, it was really dumb. So I'm the chief spider killer in my house. Mm-hmm. So I was alerted.
As am I, actually. Yeah. So we got that in common. Yeah.
Good. I was alerted to the presence of a spider, in a bedroom. So I went in with the vacuum cleaner because it was, it had sort of squashed itself in under one of the, cornices in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And me being short, I couldn't reach it otherwise, and I didn't want to just spray it because then it would fall down behind some furniture and may or may not have survived. So best just to be done with it. Mm-hmm. So I stood on the bed. I pulled out the telescopic thing on the vacuum and was trying to reach, and obviously just stood too close to the edge of the bed and got that bit of the mattress where it just, sort of falls away. Mm-hmm. And so I toppled over and landed with my rib cage on the edge of a chair that was next to the bed. I did get the spider though.
But did anyone get it on video?
No.
Because it would have been hilarious.
Probably.
I'm only saying that because I know that you're okay. Bruised ribs, bruised ego maybe, but yeah.
Well, I mean, nah, the ego is, you know, I'm a clumsy person. I accept that. It's just part of my charm.
But I now understand that there probably was danger when I was trying to replace a fluoro light in the office while standing on a office chair.
Yeah. With wheels, yeah. A swivelly office chair with wheels. Yeah, that's a lot worse than standing on a mattress.
At least you had the good sense to take a photo of that to explain to future employees what not to do.
Well, I also used it to suggest that we might need to buy a stepladder for the office, which we still haven't done, I believe.
And longer shirts for me.
that's probably a new problem.
I was probably sharing more than what I needed to. Peter Kelly would be proud.
For listeners, his trousers were in an appropriate place, all right?
It was something else that was hanging out, yeah. Yeah, that was one of the reasons I went on a diet. Anyway, that's up. Look, I'm glad it wasn't a serious injury sustained. And, a little bit of uncomfortable. So I've had some rib issues before, so.
Yeah, just lots of Voltaren and trying not to move too much.
Yeah, nice. Mm. Well, that was a great story.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, we should probably introduce our guest in.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So I'd like to introduce our guest for today. She started her career as a chartered physiotherapist and now works as a professional coach. She holds a master's in human factors and a PhD in expertise and human performance and is founder and company director of Island B. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Trudy Taylor.
Hi, thank you.
Trudy, great to have you on. Some very astute listeners would be aware that we actually were on a panel together for NIBOSH, and that's actually how the two of us met. And we got along so well, I thought, hey, I'd love to have Trudy on the podcast. So thank you very much for coming along and accepting our invitation.
Oh, no, it's great. It's great to be able to have another chat with you. I didn't feel like it was quite long enough, but then maybe the listeners would have disagreed.
Yeah, we'll find out if they actually tune into this or not.
Feedback.
All right. Well, Trudy, what do you like to listen to? Do you have any favourite podcasts?
Oh, do you know, I'm feeling slightly old-fashioned and dinosaur at that question, actually, because I've only just recently converted from the written word to audiobooks. That was mainly through COVID when I was really quite unwell and couldn't open my eyes. So I just sort of plugged in for 3 or 4 days. But probably podcast wise, I tend to sort of veer between worky, sort of, you know, interesting CEO conversations, because I work a lot with senior leaders, and then children's history, so that I can listen with my kids and may, you know, not show how little attention I paid to history at school and can't remember any dates or what actually happened in the Fire of London. So yeah, it's a bit of a spread, and it's very random. And obviously your podcast is something that I've been listening to lately since meeting Jason, and find out what you guys are doing.
Yeah, we'll have her back.
Yeah.
It might have changed my whole life and turned me to podcasts now. So.
Yeah. When did I start listening to it? Probably a few years back now. I never thought I'd be doing my own podcast, but here we are, over 100 episodes in.
Yeah, I think maybe 2019 I started listening, 18, 19, something like that. Somebody at work got me listening to Adam Grant, I think it was. So, yeah.
Yeah, he'll come on our podcast soon. Adam, if you're listening.
Adam, come on now.
Yeah.
Let's move it along. Trudy, tell us about your professional career, please.
Well, I think Jason's sort of given you the quick summary of it. but my early career in physiotherapy has actually been quite relevant to what I do now, because whilst I don't sort of do much in terms of physical rehab and that kind of thing, but what I ended up working in physio was sort of complex pain management. And it steered me down the road of considering whole systems, people's whole systems, quite, you know, sort of an organic system that's very complex and doesn't tend to behave itself and show up as you think it should. So it caused me to sort of be a bit more questioning, thinking about when we were getting people better and then we're sending them back out into the world, was that, you know, we'll be shoving them straight back into the causative factors and then bringing them back in to fix them again. And was that really a sensible way to be for any of us? And I suppose the other really interesting link for me at that time was the link between psychology and emotional well-being and pain, and the perception of it and how we deal with it, and how it's kind of, in chronic pain patients, kind of keeps you in a loop of pain that maybe doesn't all have an organic basis anymore. So I got sort of curious, having done a bit of psychology in the past. I think that sort of took me down that road. And then together with the, you know, what happens when you leave the physio departments and you go out back to work and life, took me down the road of human factors. So they all sort of came together, and doing my master's, I was 30, I think, at the time. So it was a complete change back into education. And that's where I really got my, you know, first look at proper systems thinking and, you know, sort of really understanding the systemic nature of risk. And it got me sort of very interested in that, and then ended up working with the railway industry quite closely, doing sort of safety culture and behavioral change. And again, it all sort of came together, and it was all a bit serendipitous in the way that I ended up coaching the exec, even though I wasn't a coach. So they were very aware that I'm not a coach, and I thought, if I'm going to do this, I may as well do it properly. So that's when I trained as a coach and qualified as that. So there's sort of a blend of sort of weird meandering backgrounds. By the time you get to 51, you've got a bit of a colourful CV and there's no straight lines. So that's how I've ended up with Island B, sort of doing a mixture of a coaching approach to change individually and organisationally, trying to bring the two together.
Yeah, I think we see a similar pattern in, like, people working as clinical psychologists who then come over to psych health and safety, because they see that, you know, treating people who are experiencing anxiety, depression, burnout because of work, and then they're being treated and then they're being sent back to work, and then they're relapsing back into that state of ill health again because the situation at work hasn't changed. And then, yeah, that sort of prompts them to go, well, this is a silly way to approach something. Let's actually try to solve the problem before, instead of treating the symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think my personal, I tried to work out what drove me, because I was working in safety, but not particularly safety driven, which is kind of, you know, it's a terrible thing to say to safety professionals, but I had to be honest, you know, my motivation is I can't stand the fact that we could learn and be better, but we don't. and we keep going around the same loop. So that's my driver, is kind of break into the loops.
And that's a big challenge when you're working inside the safety profession.
We find ways.
Yes. Yeah. And that's all we'll say about that.
Yeah, moving on. So Trudy, you know, I said, hey, like, I love talking to you on that panel that we did. You know, what would you like to come on the podcast and talk about? And one of the things that you suggest we could talk about was mental health and managers. So I guess why that topic? Why do you find that of interest?
Yeah, so I mean, so again, going back to that kind of whole systems thinking, it feels like if we look at the system of people and structures of organizations, we're very keen on sort of putting people in boxes and containers. So there's the front line, the workforce, and we all get very passionate and excited about that, and rightly so. You know, that's the end of the delivery. People, from a safety perspective, often put on the end of work that will potentially cause harm. And then in my work, I've often focused on the exec as well, you know, so the top leaders, and sort of trying to support them in thinking and behaving differently. And also had to, you know, coach quite a few people who are not coming to me with mental health issues, but have had mental health issues. And I was sort of trying to work alongside that. And then the people that seem to get lost in the middle for me are these middle managers and frontline managers. So they're sort of and often referred to in quite derogatory terms by some organizations I've gone into as a kind of the permafrost layer, the layer that you can't get past because we at the top know what we're doing and those at the bottom are trying their best, but these guys in the middle are making it difficult for everybody and we can't, you know, penetrate that. And that's where everything gets stuck. And I tend to think of it in a completely different way to that, and that that's the layer that's really is making everything come together. That's the hub, the place where people, you know, if it was going to be a sort of a physical network, the bit that everyone comes into and relies on being strong and steady, and you know, the workforce often rely on them being the protectors from any flack that's coming from above and from outside, and then you know, the leaders, the senior leaders are expecting them to make the workforce do what they want them to do. And so I feel like they get a bit of a rough deal sometimes. I'm not saying that's always, and there's some organizations where it's done really well. And I think they have described, you know, feeling that squash from both sides, can't do right for wrong, as we say here. And it doesn't matter what I do. And I think that sense of, we know that stress is this, you know, perception of how much we can do based on the resources that we have and the demands that are placed on us. And if you're in their position, then that's causing an awful lot of stress, but not an awful lot of support. And so I think they are A, squash in the middle, but B, fundamental to supporting others, and so therefore their mental health suffers, but also is incredibly important. So yeah, that's where I was coming from, I guess.
Yeah, and that's something, yeah, when we were speaking on that panel for NEBOSH, I thought, yeah, that's actually a really important point that we haven't covered so well, I think, on the podcast to date, talking about that line manager level. And I think one of the things that really brought this to light was the pandemic. You know, there was a lot of how do we care for our frontline workers? But managers were forced into like just the same sort of changes as what the frontline workers were. But there seemed to be less support maybe for managers versus frontline workers. In fact, there's actually extra burden generally for line managers, because it's like, hey, you have to cope with all the changes that your frontline workers are doing, but you need to be there as a support for them as well and try and maintain performance despite our whole business model completely changing overnight.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, it's changes like that that really show how every time something comes up in the world that is of value to, you know, such as psychological health and well-being, you know, when we started years ago talking about safety culture, when we talk about diversity and inclusion, you know, every topic that comes up is really valuable and has significance and importance. But these people are now taking another piece to their role. You know, so if you imagine you started off life, you know, because some of the environments I've worked in, people have been in these roles for years. You start off life doing a certain job, and suddenly you're now, you know, even the switch from being an operational manager and having personnel, as we used to call HR, do the people bit. And then suddenly they were asked to do people bits, and you're like, hang on a minute, I was employed as an engineering manager. And so we're sort of layering more and more things, and it's right that we do, we expand our thinking, but not without thinking of how we support people to do that. and the pandemic was a kind of a rapid escalation of something like that. You know, we suddenly said, right, now you've got to be a change manager. You've got to be, you know, looking after sort of pastoral care in a huge way, in a way that none of us really know how yet and understand. And you've got to now be a master of office design and ergonomics so that your people at home can have all the right assessments. And, you know, and in the middle of all dealing with their own stuff, their own families, their own changes in life, you know. So whilst I tend to talk about this group of people as special in terms of their position in the organization and that squash and squeeze, but also they are exactly the same as everyone else in their humanness. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes by talking about people in groups of, you know, their managers, their frontline, we forget it's all just people. And as much as we don't want to imagine that they're any different, we are all just working with the same stuff. So, yeah, so I think that threw up a massive curveball for them. Didn't really handle it all that well all the time.
So I guess within coming out of that context, what are the sorts of mental health issues that you do see occurring in managers?
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, it's probably really important that I stress that I'm not a mental health practitioner, and that my background is primarily coming from the coaching space, with a bit of psychology in the background. And I guess the coaching training that I've done has had lots of sort of psychology in there. So I'm never in a position to diagnose. But we're rather interesting. We are trained to spot the signs of, so that we don't coach through mental illness that requires another intervention. So it makes you able to see these things a little bit more easily and be a bit more aware of them. And so typically what I was hearing and discovering from people were sort of the low-grade rumblings of a lack of mental wellness. So, you know, people would start to lose sleep, not sleep so well, not eat so well, talk about things in sort of more negative terms. So, you know, the early signs of someone maybe exhibiting some mental health issues, and lots of stress, lots of people sort of feeling overwhelmed. And then those who had mental health issues in the past, finding a recurrence of those. So, you know, depression would kick back in and they start to notice that they were struggling to get up in the morning. Not just, I'm a bit tired, but, you know, I really don't know why I'm here. And, you know, so there was the whole sort of range. And there always is, isn't there? Whenever you encounter people and the words that and labels we put on, I suppose we have to be careful, because not being consultant psychiatrists, I'm not in a position to say that, but I can say I'm noticing some of these symptoms are in line with. And so it was just being aware of that, you know, and being someone who they could speak to and say, I have had these things before, and this is feeling very similar, or this is different. And so able to sort of separate them out. So yeah, it's just the stress, the depression, the anxiety started kicking in.
And I mean, recognizing that you might not have the answer to this one, but do you think that that's different to what would be presenting in, I guess, like more of a frontline workforce group?
No, I don't think the outcomes are different. I think the factors that bring about those outcomes or an exacerbation of them maybe. So I think how things present themselves. Yeah. So I think we're all susceptible to all of this. I think that's the human condition bit, isn't it? I think some of the ways in which middle managers have to work and operate and cope with the demands from different sides can sometimes increase, well, I hear it in, you know, creating much more of that overwhelm. And I do wonder whether in that group as well, there's an element of not being able to ask for help because you need to be seen to be looking after others and holding the fort both up and down. Yeah. So I don't think it's that much different. I think the outcomes are the same across people.
So Trudy, you said that, you know, you now, I guess, due to your experience and background, you're starting to look more at the human factors rather than the symptoms. And so thinking about the systems that might be affecting, you know, health outcomes. Yeah. So what systemic factors do you think in particular play a role in the mental health or ill health of managers?
So I guess the things that I see most that people come to, say, a coaching space with are around some of the reasons why we work and what we get from work, and then when they disappear, how that leaves us. So I'm thinking more of, you know, feeling like you have a reason for being each day, turning up with purpose, understanding your role, having a real clarity around that, feeling like you have the support to make decisions, the autonomy. You know, I think we really underestimate the impact of a perceived or real loss of autonomy has on someone, because we are autonomous beings. And I think the way that we've designed systems has been around a machine thinking, and then we've kind of plonked people in, and then when we stretch and pull and direct them according to the machine, we wonder why they break and, you know, fall over or bend or don't produce what we want them. So we just, you know, whip them harder and in exactly the same way. And I think we're kind of really missing that piece around people having control. And I think, you know, again, going back to the pandemic, and I know we keep harking on about it, but it's been so recent, and I think it's really shown things up, is that the lack of control came from all angles. And in, you know, in younger children, it was presenting itself in terms of anxiety, eating disorders, all sorts of things came to the fore. And actually, I think in adult groups as well. And so we were starting to see people sort of feeling this lack of control. And so that autonomy was really being challenged. And I feel quite strongly about that, because once you start to create that, you can create really smart workplaces. Because if you start from a position of people know what they need, because we've asked them, and actually after years of not being able to express what they need, they are coaxed into, you know, being able to say what it is, then you can then design really great systems around that. So for me, the clarity, control, designing your own space, and usually you end up, I mean, we've known this for years in terms of the science that's come out of it. It's still, I still find it fascinating and infuriating that we haven't just gone and taken that leap and said, you know what, people really do know how to design the work best for themselves.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, even things like self-determination theory have been around for decades.
Exactly.
And just understanding that importance of autonomy and, but also relatedness and competence, you know, actually having, you know, positive relationships at work, whether that's peer support, whether it's supervisor support, feeling like there's people that you can draw upon, right? And then competence, like feeling like you have a sense of mastery in what you're doing and can see the outcomes of your efforts as well, is important. So even just thinking about those three elements, right, like having positive relationships, having a sense of autonomy, having, you know, the sense of competence and mastery in work. We just think about those three factors for work, then, you know, that's a good place to start.
It is. And it's, and so I, you know, I'm always curious as to if it's so simple, and if it's so evident and we know this, then I'm always curious about what is it that's stopping us? And I think it comes around to a couple of things potentially. One is it almost sounds too easy.
Mm.
You know, it sounds like it can't just be that. How can you begin to affect mental health by just giving people those things? Well, we know that that's what feeds our souls, right? It makes us work well and live well. So why not? I think the other one is, how do we adapt that thinking to the systems that we currently have that feel so rigid and right? And who's going to take that bold move and go, let's just, I don't know, throw it all up in the air and start again. And I'm just working with within a startup with a senior leader who has fully embraced this. So, and I guess they've got a bit more autonomy in how they're, you know, sort of evolving as an organization. But within his own team, he's had some feedback on engagement, and there was, you know, and he said, we started to unpick each one, which is the traditional way of looking at engagement. So we go, like, well, there's the problem. It's about, you know, how do you have a good friend at work relationships? Mm. And, you know, do you feel like you can come and do your best work each day? You know, there's your self-determination, your mastery. And, you know, are you paid well enough, et cetera, et cetera. And you can pick each one of those off, as is the tradition within engagement workshop process. I said, how about you just go and ask them what they need? And then, and of course, the first thing was phones, laptops, more money. Okay, we worked through that, blah, blah, blah. Now, what do you really need? What is it that you're saying that, you know, so, and all the assumptions he had about what they thought they wanted and their assumptions about what they thought would dissipated. Mm. And they suddenly came down to, you know, given the work constraints, we know we need to get here. So we know this from good human factors thinking, set the outcome, set the constraints, ask people how they're going to get there. And so he's now in the process of saying, if we were to take a blank piece of paper with the outcome for our work and the constraints that we have to deliver on, how would we design this team's work? How would you want to work? And I think that's really exciting and bold, but very simple. But it's quite scary for him. You know, he's, I wouldn't say too much about him, but he's from a technical background. This is like, you know, really free flowing people stuff. But these are people who work long hours. And so as simple as this might sound, being unhappy at work and feeling disengaged and then working long hours and not feeling valued and all these things will eventually lead to some degree of, like, you know, well-being degradation, stroke, mental unwellness, you know, depending on what base level they've already got.
Yeah, you need to have a lot of buffers in place, right, when people are working those demanding roles and the long hours and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. But to give them some control back, I think, is the key.
Exactly. So if people are going to work long hours, that's a demand. So looking at things like give them that sense of control, the positive relationships, the sense of mastery, then all of those things can potentially buffer some of the demands. We do know at some point in time, it doesn't matter how many buffers you have in place and how many benefits you're providing, the demands do take a toll. And companies need to be cognizant of that. But it's nice that you're able to work with people in that regards. But I guess going back to the conversation specifically around managers, if they're starting to show symptoms of mental ill health, how do you suggest that, you know, that is dealt with by companies?
Right. So it really does depend on what environment they're in. So some organizations will be better set up for this kind of thing. And some are less so. So if we think about the best case scenario, is it some kind of in-house mental health first aider competence? So, you know, enough people know about it, they're aware of it, they're talking about it. So it's okay to bring it to the fore. You know, you're not asking this person that you meet who's struggling to be the first person to speak up in a place that doesn't understand them. My job really on a one-to-one is always to have that conversation with them and what I'm noticing in them. So, you know, I'm noticing that the last three times you've come in and this is how you're feeling, you've used these words, is it time we got you to a doctor? And so in the UK, typically our first port of call would be your local GP. Not diagnosis, but just, you know, sometimes, but mainly just as a flag to make sure that you're under care. And that comes from my, you know, code of conduct with the International Coaches Federation. That is what I'm expected to do.
Trudy, like, I think that's really important that sometimes people hold up that mirror and go, hey, you know, this has been a change that I've seen and I think it's time for you to get some help. I mean, thinking back to Brian Henderson, and him sharing his personal story of burnout, he didn't understand like how bad it was because it's kind of like that, you know, frog and ball in water.
Yes.
Just didn't notice that it was getting worse and worse and worse. It wasn't until I think he was actually getting some quite bad symptoms, getting very ill, that he actually went and saw the doctor. Yeah, so it's good, I guess, for people in your position who are in this profession, maybe not mental health professionals, but just noticing that change in behaviour to be able to, you know, to escalate or promote escalation to, you know, professional health care providers.
And I think, you know, in a way, anyone can do that. And the reason we can do that is twofold. One is that we care enough to notice someone. So, you know, we notice how people are and we pay attention to them. So we're not all in ourselves, which is easy to do, you know, we get bogged down with this stuff. So notice the people around you as human beings and how are they normally and what seems to be different. And then the second one is kind of having the courage to say something because, gosh, you know, in so many environments, it's like, well, what's it got to do with you, you know? And so it's thinking about how you go about doing that. And so that is something that any human being can do because we all have the ability to know people And we all have the ability to ask a question and to, you know, in a quiet space, in a safe, private space with kindness. And people sense that. They sense when you're interrogating and accusing, and they sense when you're coming in with a good intention. And so simply saying, you know, what is it that we can do with this? Because this doesn't feel great. And I'm concerned. And, you know, we've all had to do that with a friend at some point and say, you know, you're not looking happy. Do you want to talk? It doesn't have to be an extreme example. So what is it you need? Again, it comes back to what you need. Now, someone in a, you know, this is my experience again, is someone who is very much in a heading down the sort of mental unwellness route will struggle to be able to say what they need at certain points. So that's when you might have to be the more directive friend and say, I think we might need to get you to a doctor. Would you do that for me? Would you come back and tell me you've done that? And, you know, that, and that I can do that because that is my duty of care, but I can also do that as a friend or as a colleague. So I think, you know, coming back to our original conversation around managers, they are in a position to do that. Then who does that for them?
That's right. Yeah.
And that's what I wonder, you know, where do they go? Because as you, we know, as you go up, you know, it's lonely at the top, they say, but actually in the middle bit, you might not have those peer groups. You might not be part of that team of your own cohort. You're still doing that sort of managing down. That might be your team. So I think, yeah, that would be my question. Where do they go?
Yeah. Cause I guess a line manager would have, you know, daily interactions with their team. And they could, like you say, spot the changes in their team and to intervene. But, you know, a line manager might not see their peers who might be in totally different departments, you know, day to day, and their interactions with their superiors might be infrequent compared to their own interactions with their own team. So
they might actually be competing with their peers for resources. Absolutely. And like performance. You know, sort of positive performance recognition and all of those types of things. So they're not necessarily a, well, they're peers. They're not necessarily a group that's based on trust.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, those trusted peers where they can have those relationships. Yeah, or discussions. Yeah. So,
yeah, I don't think I answered your question, did I, Jason?
No. So I think I'm still, yeah, I've still got a question mark next to that one. I mean, one thing, obviously, and one of the focuses of this podcast is to talk more about the systemic things, right? So rather than the reactive, hey, we've noticed signs of ill health.
Yeah.
It's, well, if managers keep getting unwell, what's wrong with the systems?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess that will differ from company to company and require consultation with that group. But I think that's probably a practical takeaway for our listeners. Like when you are doing a psychosocial risk assessment, make sure that you don't just focus on the front line. Actually think about the levels of workers, the hierarchy that you might have in your organizations, and maybe even, you know, look at that as a subset of people and go, are there commonalities in terms of the hazards that these people are reporting that are having a detrimental effect on their mental wellbeing?
Yeah, yeah. And certainly some of the environments that I've worked in, they definitely, when you survey them, you will get huge amounts of pressure, like pressure-based questions will come up. And you know, for me, the way that I tackle those is I will go in then and ask them, what is this looking like? Where is it coming from? Is it real or perceived? And in which case, you know, what's driving the perception? Because the perception is real, right? So that's how we start to tackle those at a systemic level. You know, what is it about the way that work is set up or people are speaking to each other that is conveying that? So sometimes the system is driving behaviors as well, and they're stuck in a loop. And so you work with both of those.
I think there's also opportunity for the employee to say to the manager, you know, in the same way that you could say that as a manager to the employee, because you are seeing your manager probably more frequently than your manager might be seeing other people. So, yeah, it is okay for you to say, hey, I've noticed you've been a bit short-tempered lately. Is everything okay? Or you haven't seemed like yourself lately, depending on the relationship. And obviously there are significant power dynamics there.
Yeah. I know. I remember the day the Queen died and I came into work and I was a bit like, and I don't think it really affected me. Well, kind of affected me a bit, but you picked up on it. You're like, oh, you don't seem your usual self.
Yeah, I do that a lot. Not just with you, but with people. Yeah.
I am usually my usual self. I'm pretty...
You are pretty consistent most of the time. Yeah. I remembered a few times I'm like, hey, give me some work.
Mm.
You don't need to do it all yourself. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, that's actually, yeah, that's been good. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Hasn't happened lately, but I think that's because you've been stoned under yourself.
I've had plenty of
no capacity. To keep going. No capacity. Yeah.
Capacity. That's right. Yeah. But yeah, so I think that I guess part of that as a leader is also building those relationships with your teams where they do actually feel comfortable and have a level of compassion and a relationship with you where they can actually feel confident in expressing those concerns.
And the manager being willing to share, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if something isn't right, like, so, you know, if their workload is unmanageable or, you know, something is happening at home or whatever, being willing to share down. And some managers, I can understand why they would want to have a barrier potentially, but there's value in bringing down those barriers.
Yeah, and it may even be saying, hey, thanks for checking in.
Mm.
And that's all that you need, and that's the prompt that you need to say, okay, somebody else has noticed this and maybe I hadn't noticed it myself, but, yeah, I'm going to go and have a chat to my doctor or my spouse or whoever is a trusted advisor that I can go and speak with.
Yeah, for sure.
I think in that respect, you know, there is always this blend of the – we talk about the system and thinking of in terms of structure and process, but actually the system is also the culture and the behaviours that are going on around and the thinking and the conversational practices are, you know, part of your overall system. So in those dynamics, can we look at one, you know, are there certain, I always look in the system, what is it that's in here that's creating a lack of trust or psychological safety, which is the kind of the bedrock to being able to speak openly to somebody and to be vulnerable? And is the way that work is set up, the way the organization is set up, the systems, you know, is there something around the way that people are rewarded that causes them, for example, like you said, Joelle, that, you know, could cause peers to compete so much that they can't then be open with each other? Because then you're setting up, you know, in sort of safety terms, a latent factor for a long-term mental health implication, I think, because that working like that is lonely and you feel unsupported and you feel like you're, you know, the only control you've got is the one that you bring yourself, and that might not be that great. And so we're looking at the system factors in that way, but then also how people behave around them and what that's usually the clue, actually. If people are behaving that way, then what is driving that and sort of how things have been set up.
So I think thinking about, like, so listeners who are in organisations where they're in a position to be able to change the experience of managers in their organisations, what are the steps that they can do to better support or help managers in supporting their team members?
So I think, I mean, you know, we all know this stuff, but the first thing is creating a language around this and so being able to talk. So if, you know, in organisations where they have started to create some training or workshops or policies or anything that starts to bring this to the fore and allows people to talk with a common language about, you know, are you okay? And, you know, what might be leading to this at work, I think is an important part of it. And that's just the general raising awareness and prevention. I think, you know, the type of work that you do where you're doing a really structured, evidence-based assessment of the risks in an organization, I think is really quite critical, because unless we add some robustness to this, it just becomes a bit, you know, well, we'll all start talking about it and that'll be great and that's good, but actually we need to have, because we respond well to structure and process. So if we've got something to hang our hat on and say, how are we doing in this risk factor, what's this showing up as, how do we benchmark it, and therefore what are the things that we need to put in place? And I think if we pay specific attention, like you say, to this group of people and see what might be showing up there, I think that's a really valuable way to start doing it. I think that's always been my way. Go in and see what the baseline is first with anything. Where are you? And then you're meeting people where they're at. And anyone who hasn't done that, I think that's a really important way to start.
Brady, it's been a great chat so far about, I guess, focusing specifically on this often forgotten group about these the permafrost. I'm going to remember that one, the permafrost.
Oh, it's so sad, isn't it? Treacle layer was the other one that was said. I was like, oh, no.
Yeah. But I guess if there's a question we like to ask all of our guests on the podcast. So looking into the future, what would your hopes for the future of workplace mental health be?
Gosh, that's like a Christmas list present question, isn't it? But I think...
you can only have one.
You can have one. As I say to my kids, it's not worked so far. So I think it's something along the lines of I think, yeah, if I had my like fairy godmother wish, it would be that we don't see this as something difficult or extra, but rather the promotion of mental wellness way beyond just dealing with mental illness is seen as, I think, one of the most significant shifts in how organizations will become more productive, more desirable to work in, more successful. And if they can see that and start to act from that position, that would be my dream come true.
Business imperative, and something that, you know, makes for a competitive, or, you know, it improves the performance of business.
It does, yeah. And
the more we can demonstrate that, the better. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we know it's true, because we know when people are happiest and well, they will function brilliantly in tricky situations at times.
Absolutely.
And Trudy, words of advice for listeners who are interested in working in the psych health and safety field?
I know there's so much out there. I think there's, you know, it's coming to the fore, there's training, you know, there's a lot of advice, there's tools like you guys, you know, creating something that makes it really easier to do the right thing. For me, if you're going into that field or working in it, the skill set that I think is missed sometimes in the in all of this kind of work is around knowing how to genuinely consult with people and involve and engage. So I see a lot of pseudo engagement, pseudo consultation, pseudo involvement, and when you engage from a sort of person to person perspective, from a human to human, you really hear people, then you solve problems properly.
Yeah, I like that. Pseudo engagement, where we've got the solution already and we'll just try to encourage people to arrive at that conclusion as well.
Yeah.
I remember that actually in a previous consulting gig, where we got pulled in for a full day workshop to kind of plan out, hey, what are we going to do as a business moving forward? And then we came up with something as a group, and they were empowering us to make a decision. And they're like, oh, okay, we're hoping you'd come up with this solution, because this is what we prepared earlier and that's what we're going with.
Yeah.
At least they were overtly.
Well, yeah, that's
if they wanted us to go a certain way, they could have provided some more guidance, because we came up with a completely different solution.
Yeah, but... we could call that a failure facilitator.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. But, I agree. Yeah. So, more real engagement rather than just ticking a box and saying we've done it. Yeah,
that's it. And, you know, we do have in our legislation and in yours as well, I'm sure, Trudy, you know, duties for employers to consult with the workforce, but yeah, it can very easily just be a ticking the box exercise and sort of having a list of people who were in the room while they consulted, using my bunny ears, but yeah, not truly consulting and taking into consideration that feedback that was received. So yeah, that's a really important aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, Trudy, it's been great having you on. Great to see you again. We're going to do this probably as a monthly thing, right? Like, you know, Nibosh last month, we got this month. So next month, schedule it in now. No, thank you so much for coming along and sharing. It's been great.
My pleasure. And thank you for having me on. It's been great seeing you both.
Yeah. Well, listeners, that brings us to the end of today's episode. Remember, we do video these things and we talk with our guests. So if you want to see Joelle's bunny ears and other facial expressions that she gives me throughout the podcast, check out the Flourish CX YouTube channel. We'll also take some of the clips from this episode and we'll put it on the Flourish CX LinkedIn page. And then while you're over on LinkedIn, you know, feel free to connect with myself, Joelle, and Trudy if you want to continue the conversation. But that's it for another episode. We'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.